Hi. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, September 11th, 1996. In the Creekside room this morning, our speaker is Bob Keller. Today's session number is 6 and is titled Northwest Missions, Catholic Success, Protestant Failure. Let's listen in.
That's just sort of a very brief outline of the development of the missions and some of the background. From the first contact with the British, even I left the Spanish off of there. The Spanish explorers before Cook. And the mission period really begins in 1831 when four Nez Perce Indians travel overland from what's now western Montana to St. Louis and come to William Clark of Lewis and Clark, who's the governor of the Missouri Territory at that time, and ask him to send missionaries. And they're looking for Catholic missionaries or Anglican. They by that time, Indians have heard about Christianity and picked up bits of it from fur traders and from other people coming into the region, but there are no missionaries. So they're asking for Catholics, and what they really get are Methodists. The Methodists hear this story and publish it in their periodical, the Christian Advocate. And that's what Jason Lee responds to. Jason Lee organizes a group to come out to Oregon. They come by ship. And they're supposez to be coming to the Nez Perce and the Flatheads in Montana. They, for some reason that nobody's ever quite figured out, they decide to go to the Willamette Valley. Are you from around here?
Right. Okay. I just finished reading Lewis and Clark's, that new book. It's a fantastic book, and it just ties into this, this expedition.
So, Jason Lee settles in the Willamette Valley and starts the Methodist mission there. The next year, a man named Samuel Parker comes through. He's a Congregationalist, examining the place for a group called the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, which was an ecumenical group of Presbyterians, Congregationalists, and Reformed. And following that, then that 1836, Marcus Whitman comes and starts the mission at Walla Walla. 2 years later, a Roman Catholic priest named Blanchet starts the Catholic missions. And a Methodist named Henry Perkins moves out from the Willamette Valley over to the Dalles and starts a Methodist mission right at the Dalles. The most famous Catholic missionary, Pierre de Smet, comes into the Northwest in 1841 and starts a mission in Montana, and so on. The boundary questions finally settled in 1846. That's always in the history books. And the following year, the Whitmans are massacred. That pretty much wipes out the Protestant missions. It wipes out the Whitmans, but the others fold up. They pull out at that point. After the massacre, there's a war with the Cayuse Indians. By 1855 is when the treaties are negotiated that set up the reservations and remove the Indians from most of the land. That's followed by another war. And one of the things, notice how fast all this is happening. I mean, I forgot to, the first group coming across the Oregon Trail is 1842. And I think there are about 150 or 170 in that migration. By 1844-45, there are 5,000 people who come across the Oregon Trail. By 1855, there's tens of thousands, and they've basically taken over in about 13 years. You put that in our terms, you just have to think back, what if somebody showed up here and started moving in on us in about 1983, in small numbers, but started settling around, And now they own the place. And we were sort of the outcasts. And that's 13 years. Just trying to think where you were in 1983 and how fast that time has gone. So then there's the war. The Indians are removed from the land, and most of the missions are, those missions are gone. Okay, I put the Roman Catholic missions in red and the Protestant missions in the green. So the Catholics established it in this early period, missions at Lummi, the Lummi Indians, and the Tulalips. That's now near Ferndale, near Bellingham, and this is near Everett, Washington. Protestant mission is Skokomish on the Hood Canal. This is the Jason Lee mission in the Willamette Valley. I put Vancouver down there because the Hudson Bay Company had a missionary in there who did approach the Indians for a while. That'd be an Anglican mission. Both the Protestants and the Catholics had missions at the Dalles, competing with each other.
Thank you.
And I assume you know that in this period of time, the Catholics and Protestants really don't like each other. You saw the film last night where some of the missionaries in New Guinea were talking about the Catholics and the others, and that real distrust and dislike and denunciation of other Christians is, that kind of attitude is very prevalent in the 19th century, especially Protestants toward Catholics. But both of them think the other is going to hell, and they're quite convinced of that. Catholics established a mission at Yakima. There's a Protestant mission in a place called Shimnap on the lower Yakima River. Catholic mission at Umatilla. Walla Walla, or Wailapu, is the Marcus Whitman mission. That's Protestant, that's Congregationalist. These are Methodist. Presbyterian, Congregationalist mission at Spokane, Catholic mission at Colville. And also with the Whitmans came a man named Henry Spaulding, started a mission to the Nez Perce at Blackway. And a man named Smith started another Nez Perce mission at Cameo, which is further up the Clearwater River. This map isn't in proportion. This is still in Idaho. This is this Clearwater goes off the Snake up here. Catholic mission in the Bitterroot Valley in Montana called St. Mary's Mission. That's this Met's first mission. Another Catholic mission is founded at Coeur d'Alene. It's called the Sacred Heart Mission, and eventually they move it over to Cataldo. You may have stopped or seen the Cataldo mission. It's right on Highway 90 after you leave Coeur d'Alene and go over the mountains. It's still standing. And the Catholics established a mission to the Flatheads. Okay, what happens? We're going to erase all the missions that disappear, that fail and disappear after the wars or in the 19th century. This one disappears. That one. Actually, the Protestants leave Spokane, and the Catholics come in and sort of take over their mission there. It becomes a Roman Catholic mission. Coeur d'Alene stays in the Flathead. St. Mary's disappears. And both of these.
What year was this snap about?
This is happening right after, a lot of it happens after the Whitman Massacre in 1847. Some of them don't survive the wars after 1855-56. And some of them are a bit later. The Congregational Mission at Skokomish was founded in the 1860s. stayed there for about 30 years and eventually disappeared. So you can see by that that it's what's left is mostly the red, which are the Roman Catholic missions. They had a hard time too. I'm not trying to say that the Catholics succeeded whatever they did and the Protestants always failed. Number of Catholic missions failed just as badly as Protestant missions did. But others held on. If you look today at the religious composition of the reservations, usually on a reservation there's a denomination which is dominant, even if there's a lot of competing denominations. Like in New Guinea, we saw last night about all those groups. That was just a few of the groups competing in New Guinea. I forgot how many he said were in there. On the Navajo reservation in the United States, an example of the competition is that there's something like 250 different denominations on the Navajo Indian reservation, all trying to save the Indians. But usually there's a dominant religion, and in this part of the country, in western Montana, on the flatheads and there, and in around Coeur d'Alene, it's basically Catholic. Also mainly Catholic around Spokane. The Colville Reservation has a number of denominations, but the strongest one is the Catholic Church. I'm not aware what's down here. There isn't a reservation there anymore. On the Yakima Reservation, the Catholic mission got wiped out there, but the Catholics later came back. And after the Catholics left, the Methodists came in the 1870s. And today, the Yakima Reservation is pretty much equally split between Methodists and Catholics. The dominant religion, both at Tulalip and Lummi up here, is Roman Catholic. And the Catholics are, I think, fairly strong on the Pinault Reservation up here. That comes about later. Overall, in the Northwest, as you can tell by that, the generalization you can make is that in the long run, bringing the Christianity to the Northwest, the Roman Catholics are more successful than the Protestants. And that they're still there on the reservations in a way that Protestants are not. And well, that's what I'd maybe like to talk about in a few minutes of why that is so. First of all, just some books if you want to pursue this further. There's a number of very good books about this history. A book was just published last year by Robert Carriker, who's a history professor at Gonzaga University. It's a biography of Pierre Desnet, who is by far the most outstanding Roman Catholic missionary in the history of the United States. That's a fairly short book. It's very easy to read. Carriker is a Roman Catholic writer. He's somewhat biased in favor of his man who's his hero. An excellent book is by a man named Robert Burns called The Jesuits and the Indian Wars of the Pacific Northwest. And that deals with all this history we've been talking about here. The founding of the missions, the coming of the Jesuits, the conflict with the Protestants, and how it eventually ended in warfare. Burns is a Jesuit himself, so you take that into account. The best book of all of these, I think, but also a very long book, but I think by far the easiest reading and most interesting is by Alvin Josephy. It's called The Nez Perce Indians and the Opening of the Northwest. And it covers this whole history up to about 1880 through the Nez Perce War. It has a lot of the mission history in it. Robert Josephy is an Anglican. Robert Boyd, a book called People of the Dalles, that's just published this year. And it's about the mission, about the Methodist mission down here at the Dalles, and Henry Perkins, who is the main missionary there. This book, Eugene Hun, Mishawana, The Big River, is a anthropology book about the culture of the Indians living along the Columbia River, this area where we are right now, right about in here. You can't understand the missions and what was going on with the missionaries unless you understand the native culture and what the missionaries were running into and what they were trying to change. And you read a book like this, at least for me, it gives me a great deal of respect for the native culture. It makes me wonder, you know, why if anybody would want to sort of radically change it, because it was doing very well. But of course, it couldn't have continued on once the settlement began. Samuel Parker's Exploring Tour, that's a very old book. That was written, Samuel Parker's the man that came out here trying to decide whether to send a mission in 1835 to 37. He traveled all the way across what was going to become the Oregon Trail, and he kept a journal as he came through here, and that journal has been published as the Exploring Tour of Samuel Parker. If you like to read old books, old documents, that's a lot of fun to read. Early descriptions of this country before it was settled. Andrew Splon, Kamiokan, the title is Kamiokan, The Last Hero of the Yakimas, or something like that. It's a biography of the leader of the Yakimas who led the resistance against the whites and against the missions. And finally, this is, I think, still the best biography of Marcus Whitman. It's by Clifford Drury, who's a Presbyterian minister. He wrote about the life of Marcus and Narcissa Whitman. There's another book I put up there, I think, by a woman named Julie Jeffries. It's a biography of Narcissa Whitman, which is also very good. Okay, enough to keep you busy. My point is that there are some very good, I consider all these excellent books. There's some very good books about the history of Christianity and the church in the early Northwest. And we were talking before some of you came in about the sort of sugar-coated type of history we're taught in school. If you go to school in Washington State, you learn about Jason Lee, you learn about Marcus Whitman and their great heroes. And we name schools after them, we name shopping malls after them, and all kinds of things. And in that history, as it's taught in the schools, you seldom see the problems they encountered. You seldom hear about the difficulties they caused or the people they were supposedly helping. You don't hear about their failures or their clay feet. And all of these books, although some of them are quite sympathetic to the missionaries, are good histories in that they look at the problems as well as the what successes they had. Okay. Now, I thought it would be useful I'd like to do two things in the time we have left. One is to try to see if we can figure out why the Catholics were so successful and the Protestants weren't. And then I'll maybe take some time and just read some passages from diaries and journals and letters of the Protestant missionaries. I'll read some fairly short passages and see if you can tell what cultural problem they're running into, what they are, why they're having this, the difficulty they think they're having. But let's deal first with the sort of comparing the Catholics and the Protestants. What would you guess, or what would you think would be some of the differences that would account for Roman Catholic success and Protestant failure?
Well, the Protestants came in with their whole families and had to set up, you know, different kinds of households, I would think, and communities than just a Catholic, you know, missionary coming in by himself or with one or two others.
Good, okay, I think that's a major factor.
I think the Protestants were developed from Puritanism. Mm-hmm. I think there were probably a problem there in their approach to different cultures, just that Puritan ethic, I guess, maybe not present in the Catholics.
It's present, but it's not so strong.
That's what I mean. It's a, I think they're more accepting or tolerant. Yeah.
Hey, there's a difference in attitudes of tolerance. There's some things the Catholics won't tolerate either. But generally, they're willing to wait longer. Or another way to put it, they're more patient with the cultural differences. The Protestants tend to be very intolerant, rigid, and absolutely sure of what they think. And they have much more of a "this is right and this is wrong" attitude. And at least with the Whitman, Spalding, the American Board missions, they come right out of New England, the Puritan New England background. The Methodists don't, but they have a kind of pietistic or a different kind of intolerance for certain things. Dancing, for example. They did not like None of those Protestants liked dancing. The Catholics didn't have that much problem with native dancing.
So they would bring in some of the traditions of the Indians into their ceremonies.
They could adapt much more to the ceremonies. Mm-hmm. You saw the film last night. The same issues are going on in that film right today as are going on back then, including the one you mentioned about the concept of the clergy or the missionary, and are they to be single or married? They bring their families along. If they bring their families along, how do they want to live? On the film we saw last night, we saw missionaries in way back in remote New Guinea building beautiful homes, complete with washing machines, microwaves, televisions, everything we would have in our homes, among people who are living in brass huts. And that creates an enormous gulf between the people you're serving and yourself. And that happened in this case. Marcus Whitman amassed a great deal of wealth. We have an inventory of everything he owned, but at the time he died, it's in Drury's book. He has about 3 pages of Whitman's possessions that they saved. And he was a very wealthy man, and he'd become wealthy out there in about 10 years that he'd been there. Cattle, household goods, clothing, had an enormous wardrobe. And that's all, and he didn't see any of that as being inconsistent with his idea of what it was to be a missionary or a clergyman. What else can you think of?
I raised four children Catholic because my husband was Catholic, and they're taught so young, you know, all about the Catholic Church and what's right, what's wrong. They go to confession real young. There's mortal sins and there's venial sins, and they're taught this, and they're taught to say the rosary, and this stuff is embedded in them when they're real, real young, so they just, you know, it's their religion for their life.
Of course, that wasn't happening here because they're coming out to people who are already adults and trying to convert them.
Oh,
And they don't have the manpower right at first to set up school systems. Eventually they do, and the Catholic schools tend to be very effective. And they build many more schools than Protestants do, and they do pay more attention to the children than the Protestants do. But in this period we're talking about, the first contact, they're dealing with adults who have a different religion. They have their native religion they have to deal with. What else could you think of? What do you think might turn off Indians about missionaries? If you were an Indian, put yourself in the place of the native people. You're here, and these missionaries have shown up and want to say they want to save you. What things might they do that would seem negative to you, make you perhaps unhappy with them?
Concept of land, ownership.
Okay. There again, that's related to the first one. The Protestants wanted to own some land for their churches, but they also wanted land for their houses, their cattle, their farms, and they started making a settlement. Priests are living by themselves, they're eating much more of the native food, and they're not, they need a place for their church or their mission, but they don't start making a settlement the way that the Protestants did. But it gets much more serious than that. The mission lands, I think, could have been handled, but something much more serious starts happening fairly soon from the Indian point of view. Who else wants land?
The government.
Not at this point. The government's not in here. There's almost no government.
The trading companies and the mercenaries?
No, they've been here a while, and the Indians get along with them. They take some land, but they're not much of a threat.
I assume other white people followed in and started settling around the missions.
Yeah, the Oregon Trail starts. The immigrants start coming across, and they're settlers. They're not traders. They're not just passing through. They're coming, and they're settling, and they want land. And what land do they want? They want the best land. They want the fertile land, the river bottom land, where the rivers come in. They start occupying that land. And whose side are the missionaries going to be on? The missionaries have come to help and to save the Indians. But when the white settlers start showing up, who are they going to be loyal to?
And identify with the settlers.
They identify with the settlers. They don't only identify with them, they start helping them. Marcus Whitman, especially, who was a physician, begins helping them with health problems. They take orphan children. And Whitman goes back, and Jason Lee goes back, and starts saying, we need more white people out there. They bought the idea that the way to convert the Indians was to bring in more white people to show what a Christian society was like. Catholics, for some reason, never did that. They did it. They're more like that film we saw yesterday. The missionaries go out, settle among the people, and don't try to bring along all of Europe with them. They have very different attitudes toward what it meant to convert to Christianity. The Protestants would say the Catholics had a very low expectation of someone. It's the issue we saw in the film yesterday, right at the end. Are you going to baptize these people when they don't know what's going on? Or are you going to hold off until they know, they have some knowledge? Protestants generally said, especially the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists, the people out of the Puritan tradition, said, you really can't become a Christian unless you can read the Bible. You can't become a Christian unless you understand the doctrines, the basic doctrines. Unless you understand, not just recite the Apostles' Creed, but understand what it means and read the Scripture. And so they started translating into the Bible into the native languages. They started teaching them to read and trying to raise their educational level and make them, Americanize them in many ways. Catholics didn't expect that. It was enough to take the sacraments. You don't have to be able to read to celebrate the sacraments. So the result is that the Protestants get very few converts. There are very few of the Indians that are willing to say, okay, you can join the church. You're ready. You can join it. And so the Catholics have a great number, begin to be great numbers. The Protestants have very few numbers. The Methodists were more successful. The Methodists weren't as demanding as the Presbyterians about that. And they would have sort of camp meetings or revivals which would bring Indians into the fold. But a man named Walker, Asa Walker, was at Spokane at the Presbyterian Congregational Mission at Spokane for 9 years. He started it about 1838 and he was there through the Whitman Massacre. 9 years living there, working full time, and the mission staff and his wife, his children, all trying to Christianize the Spokane Indians. And you know how many converts he got? Zero. None. Marcus Whitman had very few. Spalding used some different methods and sort of had revivals and began getting a few more members, but they had very, very few compared to the Catholics because of their definition of church membership. This thing running out. Another factor that you may not be aware of is that the Indians had had some contact with Christians and Europeans before the missionaries started showing up in here. They had some contact at Fort Vancouver with the early fur traders. There were some Iroquois Indians that came across from Canada in the fur trade and settled up in parts of Montana, Idaho, British Columbia. Those Iroquois were Anglicans. Some of the fur traders sent Indians back to a school at Red River in Manitoba to be trained. They went to that school for 4 years and then came back out and started preaching to their own people from the Book of Common Prayer. So there was some things going on here, and most of it was either Catholic, the fur traders, a lot of the fur traders were either French trappers were Catholic, or they were with the Hudson Bay Company and they would be Anglicans or Episcopalians. So the previous kind of contact, sort of fleeting contacts with Christianity were with Catholic, Anglican Christianity and not Protestant. So that gave the Catholics sort of a little bit of a head start. The other thing the Protestant did, and it relates to what you were saying about the Puritanism, very soon they started passing laws for their community, their mission communities, and passing very strict laws, what you can and can't do. And they were laws that were basically from New England or from the eastern United States. You can't steal, you can't borrow this, you can't do this or that. And they, by 1844-45, they had enough power to start enforcing them or convincing Indians to enforce them. And a lot of the problem was not just the laws, what they were saying you couldn't do, but what the punishments were. The two main punishments they would inflict upon their own church members when they fell away were two things which were very repugnant in the Indian culture. One was hanging. There are some things were capital offenses. Murder was a capital offense. Burning a building. If you burned a building down, it was a capital punishment. And the form of capital punishment was hanging. And for some reason I don't understand, but everybody seems to agree upon this, that the idea of hanging someone, if you're going to kill someone, the idea of hanging them was very upsetting to the Indians. That's not the way you did it. They didn't practice capital punishment much anyhow. So that was very disturbing. I guess it would be like somebody coming in our society and say, we're going to pass some laws, and if you do this, this, and this, we're going to execute you, and the form of execution is not going to be hanging, electric chair, or lethal injection. It's going to be we're going to draw and quarter you in the public square. That's what, we wouldn't like that. Or we're going to skin you alive or something. Or cut somebody's head off in public. We'd find that pretty disturbing. The other punishment that they inflicted a lot was flogging or whipping. They would prescribe so many lashes for certain kind of crimes, and the whippings would take place in public. And the native people found that very, they never did that themselves, and they found that very humiliating. And that caused some difference, and that was much more prevalent in the Protestant communities than in the Catholic communities. One other one final thing. The Catholics, especially compared to the Presbyterians and Congregationalists, even the Methodists, had a much more ceremonial religion, much more ritual, much more garb, robes, much more color in their worship than Protestants, who tend to be very austere and sort of cold, black and white. And Catholics used those things much more effectively. They appealed to the Indians more than the Protestant austerity. One of the things the Catholics developed, which is very effective, is called the Catholic ladder. And actually, the first person to begin it was Henry Spaulding, who was a missionary to the Nez Perce, who was a Congregationalist. But the Catholics borrowed the idea from him and then developed it much further. The Catholic ladder was a diagram, a ladder. It started at the bottom, with the creation of the world, with the Genesis story, and you worked up this ladder basically to heaven, with all the steps on the ladder. And they had drawings and sketches that were very colorful. And this allowed them to show the Christian religion to people who couldn't read or write in visual form and get across the message. One part of the ladder, you'd fall off the ladder at some point and you'd go down into hell. That was very graphic. Or you could climb and go up to heaven. Protestants later borrowed this back and made the Protestant ladder. The Catholic ladder had Martin Luther on it, I think, falling off it at some point, going down to hell. And all the Protestants, and the Protestant ladder was about the same thing, except it had the Pope falling off it. The Catholics used that very effectively, and they were much better at that kind of visual, graphic evangelism than the Protestants were. If you want to see a Catholic ladder, there's some in museums around, but there's one in a church at La Conner. Mm-hmm. Anybody know where La Conner is?
Yeah, close to here. Yeah.
That's the Swinomish Reservation. There's a little Catholic church there, it's called St. Paul's Church, right across from La Conner. If you can get in that church, there's a Catholic ladder hanging there, about a century or more old.
I know that church, I have to go in it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, those are some of the main differences. Related to the first one, well, the concept of the clergy was also that, and this is an interpretation of mine, that the Catholics just had more staying power. They could last out more difficulties and in some ways are much better disciplined than the Protestants were. And a lot of that is related to whether or not you've got just responsibility for yourself. First of all, you've taken a vow of chastity, which means you're not going to get married. And secondly, you've taken a vow of poverty, which means you're not going to accumulate material things. So you're single and you have basically what you can carry around. That's a lot different than being married, a family, household, all that. And it was much more difficult for the Protestants to stay on or to find replacements when someone decide to leave or die or whatever, find a replacement to come out and live in this situation. Well, that's another factor. Okay, the other big item in all this change going on of people shifting from being native to being, quote, civilized, being non-Christian to becoming Christian, the other huge factor in that is the native culture itself. As I said in the first meeting we had on Monday, that when Christians came to North America to bring the gospel, they often thought they were bringing people who were just living in darkness and blighted, who had no religion at all, but that was simply not true. There was a lot of religion here, native religion, and I think you can say, by and large, it probably worked pretty effectively for the people who believed and practiced it. At least they kept practicing it for centuries and centuries, and it seemed to do the things that religion does for people. But the Protestants and the Catholics didn't understand that very well. And they certainly didn't understand the cultures they came into, the ways of life that people practiced. So part of the problem is, how are these native people going to change? And it's basically going to be a change on one side. There's changes on both. When cultures meet, both sides change. But when one side has a lot more power and dominance than the other, the weaker side has to do a lot more changing. In the first periods of contact, the Indians, there are some things where the Indians changed fairly easily and adapted to white culture. The most obvious example is the horse. They learn about horses, they get horses, and they bring horses into their culture. It really radically changes their way of life, but they have, in about a century's time, adjust to that very well. They adjust very well to things like guns, which they get from the Europeans, iron. These are cultures which did not have iron or steel. They, as soon as they see that, they want that. They had some inklings of that because they probably picked up things from shipwrecks floating over from Japan. There are some iron tools we find in in settlements before the Europeans come, but not much. So when Europeans come with all this iron, that is very appealing. They want that. They adapt to potatoes. They think potatoes are a great food and want that. They like cattle and start wanting herds of cattle. They also adapt pretty quickly to European dress. They still keep their native dress in some cases, but they start putting on pants and jackets and blouses, dresses, shirts. Hats, the way Europeans dress. That makes some sense to them. The thing that those things have in common, where they adjusted and adapted easily, there are two things all those have in common. One, they're parts of what we call material culture. They're material items like food, clothing, tools, animals. That's part of the material culture. And people usually adapt to the material culture fairly fast when the things that are new make sense to them. When it's very obvious to do something. And it's very obvious if you look at a piece of iron and you look at a shell or a piece of stone for cutting, which is the best. The cattle made some sense. Some people think that Indians saw the cattle as sort of a replacement for the buffalo. And potatoes made a lot of sense to Indians living in this part of the country and in in the Northwest because they used to eat a lot of bulb plants, camas plants and wapato and other things where they ate the tubes out of the ground. So potatoes was just seemed like another form of what they were used to eating. Those things, the change was fairly easy. In other areas of the non-material culture, change is often very difficult. And it often makes it more difficult when you try to force the change. And these are the areas where the missionaries are most concerned about. And these areas are marriage and sexual relations. How do the genders or the sexes relate to each other? How do you change that? Concepts of disease and healing. What causes disease? Where does it come from? And how do you combat it? How do you heal? That is often hard to change. Concepts of property. Who owns what? What belongs to whom? What do you share? What don't you share? Those are enormous differences between European culture and the native cultures, which are hard to change. We've already talked about land. Who owns land? Indians didn't have the idea of private property that we do, but they still had ideas that certain land was used for certain people, by certain people at certain times, and you just didn't walk in and take it, especially fishing sites or hunting areas or gathering areas. Language. It takes a long time to learn another language, especially go from non-writing to a written language is a difficult move to make. Another area in which the missionaries had a lot of trouble, especially the Protestants, was slavery. Chattel or private property slavery was practiced throughout the Northwest. And the missionaries from New England, especially those out of Puritan background, were, this is the 1840s. This is the time of abolitionism, the attempt to abolish slavery in the United States, and people are dividing very severely over this back east. The missionaries come out here, and they try and just Christianize people who are slaveholders, who own slaves or have slaves. And it's very difficult for them to accept that these chiefs and native people are practicing slavery. And finally, there's just the area of religion. What one thinks about ghosts, spirits, a deity, the cause of things, legends, stories, and all that. People tend not to change those very easily. Or if they do, they still end up adapting their new religion to their old in some way. A lot of that went on. A lot of new forms of sort of combined Christian and Indian religion eventually arose in the 19th century. The best example still exists today is what's called the Indian Shaker churches, which are sort of Indian and Christian in some, to us, very strange kind of ways. So those are all types of things that the missionaries faced. And they were trying to convert people or change them in that second area. They tried to change the material area too. They thought they should dress like Europeans. That wasn't very difficult. When they got into things like polygamy and who owns what, sharing slaves, it became quite difficult. So I'd like to just read you some passages of the missionary diaries to give examples of this, see if you can spot what the problem is in terms of culture. This is from a Methodist missionary. It's written in 1842. he said, he's talking about the Indians at the Dalles. And they've established a mission. You know, it's been there about 4 or 5 years. They got the mission station, the buildings, and they're beginning to form a congregation. They've even had a revival, a camp meeting and a revival in about 1841. He says, they do not like to stay but a little while in one place. They are here. This is hard to read. They do not like to stay but a little while in one place. They are here and there. They visit the Cathlamas, the Klickitats, the Snake Indians, the Walla Wallas, etc. In the spring, they go off to get roots. In the summer, they are at the salmon grounds. In the fall, they go another direction after berries, and after berries in the winter. In the winter, they are here, which is the Dalles. What's the problem he's run into there?
Well, it's a hunter-gatherer society, and they're not permanent settlements.
Right. They're not settled. They move around with the seasons. Mainly they had summer camps and winter camps, but they also go visiting a lot and trading. But you're quite correct. They're hunter-gatherers, and they may stay in some place for 5 or 6 months, but they're eventually going to move. And they'll eventually come back. But they're moving around. Why is that a problem for the missionaries?
They're not always there to be taught.
Mm-hmm. They've set up a school, and the school gets going, and suddenly they're gone. They've set up the church building. They can't move the church building around like that. Basically, it's that the missionaries can't or won't move. Here again, the Catholics had an advantage. The single Catholic priest living in an Indian hut, maybe sometimes they build churches that they wouldn't want to leave, but they can move with the migratory tribes much easier than the Protestant with his wife and 6 kids. The Protestants were basically stationary, and they expected the Indians to be stationary, but the culture they were dealing with was moving around. And when you tell them you can't move, which they did, they tried to convince them to stay there, it just seemed
rather stupid.
Yeah, it didn't make any sense. It's not the way you live. Life wasn't as interesting, but also you couldn't feed yourself sitting in one place.
And yet another major problem they ever talk about is sanitary conditions. If you don't move, you live in a garbage dump.
Mm-hmm.
But you move away for 2-3 months and the place cleans itself.
Well, in a garbage dump, you live in a sewage dump.
You live in a sewage dump. If you move, continue to live the way you do live in the sewage dump, mm-hmm. you'll die of diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So there's very real reasons why they had to move.
Mm-hmm. But missionaries, as you can see in this passage here, they didn't really understand. They saw them doing that, they didn't understand what the culture is doing.
Plus, when they're gone 6 months, they'd come back and the missionaries would figure they had to start over with them. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's something where you may sympathize with the missionaries. This is also from the Dalles, and they've been here a bit, and they've got a house, and Henry Perkins is married, got a wife and children. The Indian concept of visiting is very different than the missionaries. The Indian concept of privacy is very different. For one thing, during the winter months, you didn't do much hunting and gathering. Many stayed put, and you spent most of your time either telling stories or visiting with each other. And that combined with the idea that everybody shares everything in this hunter-gatherer culture. You don't say, this is my food. Whatever excess you got, you share with other people. So there's very little concept of privacy, private property, and there's a lot of sharing. Missionaries set up their houses, and the Indians, they say, parties of Indians from all parts of the surrounding country are every day coming and going. It would be a strange thing for a native to pay a visit without begging for something. Then his wife writes, the missionary's wife writes, Indians throng into the house. They come early and often and were seldom in a hurry to depart from the house. They expected to be treated with something to eat at any time. In the absence of presence of food, they became morose and prejudiced. She said she could not be very friendly to them. To protect her privacy, she locked her doors, but that didn't work. The visitors would rattle them violently, rap at my windows, and perhaps shout to be admitted.
Different lifestyle.
Different expectations. She expects her home is her castle. Her home is private. But if somebody comes in it, you let them in. And you expect them to leave at some point. You don't expect to be feeding everybody that comes in. You don't expect people to be helping themselves what they see. That drove almost all the missionary wives almost crazy. Mm-hmm. And you can say, well, that's different culture, but put yourself in their position. I mean, that's a very difficult change for them to make, as I think for most of us. Enough of a change to come to Holden Village to work for a month or so, and that whole privacy thing shifts a bit. Although we still create a lot of privacy for people at Holden, if you can find it if you need it. You know, it's much more communal than most of us usually live. But here it was wide open. So that was another problem.
You can almost see that those missions actually later would develop into churches for all the colonists that moved out. I mean, mm-hmm. It's sort of the progression.
That's what happened in the Willamette Valley. They basically became, the missions actually, missionaries began to minister to the fur trappers, to the other white settlers, and especially when things got tense or Indian wars, Indians were not welcome in those congregations. Were excluded, and the Indian mission churches became white churches. What do you think is going on here? This is these are all from this book about the Dalles. February 3rd, an Indian who gave us a horse came here last summer and forcibly took a heifer from our band, or from our cattle, and drove her away. I scolded the man severely for stealing the heifer. He would not allow that it was stealing, but only exchanging property. Mm-hmm. What's happening?
Concept of ownership. Mm-hmm.
He gave him a horse.
Yeah, he gave them a horse. Yeah. So the missionary accepts them. Thank you. That's a nice gift. I'm glad you appreciate our being here and you're supporting our mission. It's natural for people to make donations to the church. We take collections, pledges, giving programs. You've given something to the church. Very grateful. The Indian shows up the next summer and takes a heifer. And what does the missionary say? Theft. They're stealing it. The Indian, what's going on?
It's just taking. It's something that he needs at the time.
He needs it, and it's the missionary even uses the word. He says he will not allow that it was stealing, but only exchanging property. Mm-hmm. Gave you a horse. Now I need something back. Mm-hmm. Which is exactly the Indian way of doing something. Somebody needs something, you get it. When you need something later on, they give it to you or you help yourself to it. And it's understood on both sides that trading is going on. It was not understood by the missionary. That it's not exchanging, it's stealing. It violates the commandment. And it's also very aggravating.
When we were children, I remember an expression called Indian greed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which falls through, I guess, similar to
pop. Give something, back. You take it back.
Give.
But it goes both ways.
Yes.
And, But that's not understood here. Here, okay, I talked about the flogging, the laws requiring whipping. Here's an example, again, from Mission Diary. The chiefs found much difficulty in enforcing the laws, the white man's laws against their own people. This is about 1850, and the government's telling the chiefs they've got to enforce these laws. The chiefs appointed, through Dr. White, who was the Indian agent, desired that the regulation should continue. But the other influential men who are not in office or not chiefs said they had been whipped a good many times and had got nothing for it. They had been whipped a good many times and got nothing for it. They were willing that it should continue, the whipping should continue, provided they were to receive blankets, shirts, and pants as a reward for being whipped. Dr. White, wishing them to understand that they need not expect pay for being flogged when they deserved it. He told, don't expect to be paid for being whipped when you deserve the whipping. They laughed heartily at the idea and dispersed. Now, they were willing to be whipped because they thought if they subjected themselves to this punishment, they would be also rewarded for it in some way with goods, which they wanted to have. But then they got the whipping, they didn't get the goods, they didn't understand it. And to a white person, you get paid for being punished? That just is not conceivable to us. Burial of the dead was another thing. It was hard to handle. The Indians bury their dead very differently. The missionary says, the Indians think our way of burying the dead is very unfeeling. We do not clothe the bodies sufficiently. We do not furnish them with sufficient supplies for the various emergencies for their future state, etc. The Indians had buried their dead usually on islands in the Columbia River out here and left them out in the open. And the Christians thought that was terrible. And they also thought putting things with them to go with the dead person was very superstitious. And they just missed connection that way. I wanted to read you one, the bells ringing. One last example to show how hard it was for the missionaries. And you might sympathize a bit with them. This is a long description, don't read the whole thing, of what's called a spirit dance. In the winter, the tribes would get together, or they'd all come together and they'd get in the lodge, build a big fire in the middle, and they'd have these dances, which would go on all night long. I've been to these things, they're really remarkable. It's unlike anything you'd ever see in any church. And people are dancing all over, and people are sort of being, well, somewhat like Pentecostal things, where people speak in tongues and are seized by spirits and they get the shakes and they writhe on the ground. All that was happening. The missionaries were having a very hard time. And this to them looked like just paganism or the worst kind of heathenistic religion. They couldn't grasp that at all, what was going on. They thought these people were possessed by demons or the devil. Then this happened. They really had trouble with this one. I guess most of us would too if we were them. There then. When this last actor was about through, who should come in but a man painted black with a little image in one hand and a stick and a large black feather attached to it in the other hand. He took his station by the fire with a low, grumbling, singing, swinging motion, apparently unconscious of all that was going on around him. About this time, a small puppy dog was thrown near my feet, the missionary's feet. small puppy dog is thrown near my feet when a young man commenced beating the breath out of its body. And before the dog was half dead, he threw the dog into the fire and then pulled him out and took a knife and cut him open. Well, the poor little dog was still half alive. And he then took the warm blood and commenced giving it to this nigger dancer, the black dancer, painted black, to this nigger dancer who drank three handfuls of it down freely. And then he was ready to mount the stage and dance with energy and life. The missionary said, by this time I became so disgusted that I wished myself out of that place, but the crowd prevented it. It was all I could do to stay there. After he passed through his dance, Brother Waller, another missionary, gave him a talk warning them of the folly of such a course and inviting them to give it up, after which we left for home as it was nearly midnight. They usually have their dances continue 4 or 5 days and nights together, with the women dancing part of them. Eating of dogs was something the missionaries had great difficulty with. I mean, the ceremonial eating of dogs, like in that instance, his word was disgust. They couldn't handle that very well, which I can't either, for that matter. It's another example of the tremendous difference in the cultures. In the Indian way, some kind of a religious rite. And to the missionaries was something that was completely repugnant and could not begin to bridge over it. Well, that's not a very good story to end on right before our lunch. If you'd like to know more about this, and like I said, I consider all these books, including this one, quite sound and accurate and basically fair to the missionaries and fair to the native cultures. Show the dilemmas they found themselves in as far as the great adjustment that had to take place as Europeans occupied North America. There are two more meetings in this series. Tomorrow we're going to meet again at 2:00 in the afternoon like we did yesterday, and there's another film. I'll show another film which is not nearly so violent. I forgot about all the violence in that film and I decided to show it. This is about a boarding school in Canada. Actually, it's got quite a bit of psychological violence in it, not so much physical violence. Indian boarding school in Canada, run by the church. And then on Friday we'll talk about what's happening in the present day and in the 20th century with the church and Native Americans. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is that film the Anglican Church?